It's the Burt Cohen Show. Dream goes on. It's not about some other country and their significant power in the United States Congress. The dream is about America. Well, there has been a dream elsewhere in the world that in the state of Israel, which has changed radically over recent years. Well, Israel has, in the summer of 2014, done some amazing things. About 2,000 Palestinians in the largest open-air prison in the world, Gaza, were killed. Many of them children. About 64, 65 Israelis died, and I think three Israeli soldiers. And what does it say about Israel? What does it say about Judaism? Many people across the world somehow equate Israel with Judaism. You know it and I know it. But there really are differences. There's Jewish tradition and there's Israel. And it's a surprise to many maybe that really they don't go hand in hand. Well, we're going to talk about Jewish tradition, tradition of justice and ethics and getting involved and what's going on in Israel. Our guest today is Eric Mann, who has written an article called, Solidarity from a Self-Respecting Jew, Palestine Will Win. He's the host of KPFK Pacifica's Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. And he is a veteran of the Good Old Congress of Racial Equality, Students for a Democratic Society, the United Auto Workers, and the author is the author of Playbook for Progressives, 16 Qualities of the Successful Organizer. Eric, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today. Are you there, Eric?
Looking forward to the conversation.
Eric, you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Absolutely fine. Well, what was your purpose in writing this article?
Well, I mean, the first thing is you talked about two different traditions. You talked about the Israeli tradition, which claims, you know, that speaks for all Jewry. And then you spoke about, you know, kind of the long Jewish tradition that doesn't necessarily support the politics of Israel. But I sort of come out of a third tradition, which is the Jewish secular tradition that doesn't primarily wake up in the morning and see itself as Jewish. It's aware of itself as Jewish. But in my life, I've been very black identified. I've been very Latino identified. I've been very anti-war demonstrated, you know, ecological. So those have been the political categories. And in those political categories, I've been very aware of myself as a Jew, which we'll talk about in my article. You know, that's definitely how I helped to get here. But it's not when I wake up in the morning the primary way I see myself. I see myself, like a lot of other people, when some people became Zionists, other people saw themselves as socialists or communists or liberals and did not see themselves in a Jewish-centered world. So I come out of more, I would say, the Jewish, radical, secular, socialist, communist, anti-war, social justice tradition in which Jews in the United States are phenomenally overrepresented.
And that tradition goes back, oh, say, some 50 years, as you talk about in your article, you know, about the large percentage of the 1,000 or so white kids who went to Mississippi and the South in the Freedom Summer of 1964. as you point out, more than half were Jewish, even though Jews represented a tiny portion of the U.S. population, and frankly still do. What does this say? Why was such a large percentage Jewish? What does this say about Jewish values and traditions and our identities?
I think it says some very good things. I mean, I want to go back to the question I almost didn't answer, which is why did I write it, and then we'll go into that.
Sure.
I wrote it, I mean, first of all, Bert and I, we talked before the show, and
yes.
One of the things I want to be very clear about is there are sort of a lot of freelance intellectuals, we call them the public intellectuals, who I don't even know who they are. I mean, they're they're just people with opinions, and they are the big thing these days because we don't have a movement to speak for. When I was involved in the movement, there were no public intellectuals. Martin Luther King, you didn't call him a public intellectual, or Fannie Lou Hamer, or Howard Zinn. I mean, Howard Zinn was an organizer at Spelman College. He was part of the original Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He was involved in the sit-ins. So he was an organizer and an academic and a writer. So in our tradition, when you got up on the stage, like myself, you had to be the leader of something. You had to be speaking for a movement. And today we've got people that don't speak for anything but their own opinions. So those people are free to say whatever they want to say. They can say the most radical thing, the most conservative thing, because there's no consequences to them. They're like little corporations, you know. But in my case, I'm in an organization. I'm with the Labor Community Strategy Center. It's a predominantly black and Latino organization. It's been there for 25 years. And when people in organizations make statements very critical of Israel, or in this case, calling for the complete withdrawal of Israeli aid by the United States, calling for self-determination for the Palestinians, you have to assume that there may be attacks on you by the American Israeli Political Action Committee.
Public Affairs Committee. Israeli-American Public Affairs
Committee. Or others. And so, as I always have said, as an organizer, never deliver a blow if you're not ready to receive a blow twice as strong. And you can't just, you know, you can't kick the elephant and expect the elephant not to kick you back. So I waited a little bit. I waited because when I did my sort of coming out on Palestine, I really wanted to think through what I wanted to say and what would be my best angle. And, yeah, I wanted to deliver a blow. So with my support of my editor at Counterpunch, Jeffrey Sinclair, and my wife, Leanne Hurstman, we spent, 2 weeks on this article, which I really want you listeners to go on. They can now get it on my own website, www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com, and download it. And you can also go on the original source, which is Counterpunch magazine.
Right.
And, okay, so to make, as they say, a long story short,
yeah.
So I wrote the article, and then I realized that part of what I wanted to say is I was so sick of this concept of saying that Jewish critics of Israel were self-hating Jews.
Right.
That I thought this was just classic Israel. I mean, Israel is so mean, so unprincipled. I'm sorry. They can't even say there are some Jews who agree with us, there are some Jews who disagree with us, we think the Jews who disagree with us are wrong. Oh, no. They have to go to your character assassination, just like they do to the Palestinians. You know, Eli Wiesel says, well, the fight between us and the Palestinians is between civilization and barbarism.
Mm.
And I'm saying, yeah, Ellie, you're right, except you're the barbar, you're the
barbarians.
Barbaric one.
Yeah.
You know, so now they say this is a fight between Jews and self-hating Jews. Give me a break. So what I realize is those people have no moral challenge to me. I don't care what Israel, who the hell is Israel to tell me whether or not I'm Jewish? I've suffered so much anti-Semitism in my life that Israel's not fought for. I've been in the civil rights movement that Israel hasn't been involved in. I've been in the anti-apartheid movement. We haven't seen Israel. In fact, Israel is the greatest friend of the apartheid movement. So they have no moral authority over me. It's being like attacked by an oil company when you're an environmentalist. Or environmentalist, you know, yeah, right. You're a self-hating environmentalist. So my point is that I wanted to stand up and say to Israel, you know what, you can kiss it because this stuff doesn't work for me. And what it's done is the concept of self-respecting Jew, which I did come up with, is really catching on. And now people are writing articles, comments from another self-respecting Jew, from Gene Bruskin, who was with the U.S. Labor Against the War, wrote a beautiful essay onto our website. So we're trying to do what we call counter-hegemonic organizing, where ideas are won, I should say, battles are won in the realm of ideas.
Yes,
and if we even say, I'm not a self-hating Jew, I'm not at that, wait, you've already lost. Because you've accepted that
premise,
and you're trying to defend yourself. So by saying I'm a self-respecting Jew, I'm saying that those of you in Israel are not self-respecting Jews.
Excellent point. Very framing is everything.
Who are willing to kill people and kill kids and blame their parents as human shields. That means I shot a human. I mean, think what you're saying. You're using yourself as human shields, which means that it's your fault for being shot.
Incredible. Well, again, if you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Eric Mann, who has written Solidarity from a Self-Respecting Jew. And you're right, no question. Framing is everything. And you suggest that Israel and AIPAC might be more comfortable in actually fostering anti-Semitism against their Jewish critics than to simply engage in an honest debate. So they don't mind fostering anti-Semitism. That's a pretty strong statement, but speak to that, if you would, please, Eric.
Well, I wish I had the text in front of me, but, you know, I remember telling a story about it when I was, you know, when I was 13, and as I say in the article, I was pretty, you know, I really liked going to synagogue. I would go to the Temple Gates of Zion every Saturday for services, and there's a story in there in which, you know, we would give every week, we would give money to plant a tree in Israel, which
I remember.
Was really beautiful.
Yep, I did it too.
And then they would say, the reason we want to plant a tree in Israel is because Israel is fundamentally a desert. I said, that sounds great. And then they'd say, an amazing thing was that it turned out that Israel was a land without a people, and we were a people without a land. So in one draft I said, which I took out, I said, in my mind it was like they found a big vacant lot. And it, you know, what a nice thing. Nobody got hurt. You know, it was sitting there with desert, and they found this desert, and they all planted trees. And then they said, and anyway, the people who had it for 1,000 years screwed it up, which is why we have, I said, wait, who had it for 1,000 years? And I said, oh, the Arabs. They didn't say Palestinians. They wouldn't use the word Palestinians. So I said, well, wait a minute, so there were people in the land? Well, yeah, but, you know, this is true. This is what a rabbi is saying. But, you know, these Arabs have so many countries. How many countries do they need? Why don't they just take those people? So I'm saying, take what people? Well, you know, the people who lived in Israel. I'm going, what people lived in Israel?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was Arabs. So I'm saying, wait, it's getting a little confusing to me here. First, this was a nation without a land and a land without a people. Now, you got people that you want to get rid of, and you won't give them real names. And then I found out about the Nakba, which was the Israeli conscious organized military campaign in 1947 to drive out 700,000 Palestinians from what was at the time Palestine, which Israel wanted for itself. So in the article, what I say is, there's a point where even the people on your side start to make no sense. Or the people that you thought were on your side start saying really horrible things that you can't justify. And it begins to make you wonder, is there something wrong with them? And similarly, if you see somebody who says, on one hand, that this the so-called Jewish state, which I oppose the concept of a Jewish state, but now they say it's a Jewish state, it's welcome to all the Jews, anybody, except those self-hating Jews. And those Jews, what are they? They're not Jews. And so we can treat them like Arabs, who we also don't think are people. So the fact that Israel is so big on telling who's a person, who's not a person, come up with concepts like you're a barbarian, you're a self-hating Jew, you're an anti-Semitic Jew, it does, I'm sorry, it leads to, what do you want from me, the final solution? What are you offering? You know, I mean, you're pushing me when you start degrading me like that. Where is this going? So I feel like, you know, as I say in my article, my mom said, never, ever fight on the other people's terms. Stand up. Fight back. Accuse them. So when I was accused, you know, when I was told that I killed Christ, when I was told all the things about me, my mom would say, go back up to them and tell them, you're a bunch of anti-Semitic idiots. You are a bunch of racists. You are terrible people. Don't defend yourself. Go on the offensive. And I thought, that's great. You're right. Why the hell am I defending myself? Again, like I say in the article, I don't go up and say, well, actually, I didn't kill Christ.
Yeah.
Or, well, actually, some of our noses aren't very big. Or, we're not all moneylenders. If you start that argument, you've lost.
Right.
So, similarly, I'm saying bring it on about this anti-Semitic Jew because you've made a mistake. And sure enough, through you, Bert, who's reached out to me very nicely, and from Victor Grossman Wexler in East Berlin, who's 90-something, who in 1953, during the occupation, he defected from the U.S. Army and went over to East Berlin because he felt he was going to be coming back to the United States in the middle of the McCarthy period, and he didn't want to. So he fled to East Berlin, where he's lived his whole life, including now, and he's a Jew, during the, the present so-called reunification, but he still lives on Karl Marx Strasse, which is in East Berlin. So he just wrote me a beautiful letter saying, great formulation, that self-respecting Jew is the first weapon we've had in this ideological struggle. He says, whether you coined it or promoted it or both, stay on it because you're winning the argument.
Boy,
so I think for you, Bert, and me, and others, I think we want to keep putting out the self-respecting Jew because it goes to the fact, not that we're the main... We're not the main victims of this. The Palestinians are. But it just shows the Israeli government lack of ethics, lack of decency, inability to just carry out an argument on its own terms without denigrating its opponents. And its opponents have to stand up and say, sorry, you are the barbarians, dude. So where do we want to go from here?
Your life story, it's a very, very interesting story and rather unique. You, as was mentioned that you got beat up for being a Jew, and you developed a strategy for dealing with that. You're also a veteran of the civil rights and anti-war movements. And your mother told you, you write this in the article, that the Jews, and they were called Negroes at the time, the Jews and Negroes are in the same boat. What boat is that? And how do traditional Jewish values factor in that, being in that same boat? How are Jews and African Americans in the same boat, or how was that in the 50s and early 60s?
Well, again, and I don't mean that we have to agree. I just want to make a distinction. I don't perceive these as Jewish values. I know that sometimes Michael Lerner tries to talk like this.
Yes, he does.
I don't believe in this. I mean, look, Jews have done everything like everybody else. You know, it has some good values in the religion. I'm not saying it doesn't. It has values of generosity. It does have, maybe the word is not secular, but a more humanistic, a social gospel type of religious politics, at least with some wings of it. That, you know, I remember when King was in seminary school, he became very influenced by the social gospel. And the social gospel basically said that we're not here to debate whether or not God exists or not. We're not even trying to debate what his will is. We will judge you by your actions. And then other people accused King of saying, well, that's not really Christianity, because if you say we're judged by our actions, then what's Christian about that, you know?
Right.
Because we have the faith. You have to be for the faith in what doesn't exist. And basically King said, well, I'm not too interested in what doesn't exist. I don't want to debate. I want to debate what does exist. And, you know, similarly winning the argument. So I think Christianity, King speaking, it's on trial about whether or not you can carry out the social gospel. I'm not on trial as to whether or not I'm a Christian. So what I'm getting to is I do not come out of the Jewish tradition in which a lot was discussed about, quote, Jewish values. I come out of the Jewish tradition that's a socialist tradition. So it was the socialist values that we thought were important. As Jews, we thought our experience helped us understand better the socialist values. That as Jews, the oppression that we faced, as my mom said, scratch a goy and you'll find an anti-Semite. I want to take a minute on that.
Mm-hmm.
I almost used it several times. I only used it once, and I didn't. I wanted people to pick up on it. Because what my mom was saying is, but, you know, this happened to me, is, you know, in the article, Bert, when I'm six, I think, and the kids come up to me and say, you killed Christ, you killed Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it didn't have very much effect on me because I really didn't know who Christ was. But I know they didn't like me. And then they called me a Jew bastard and a Christ killer, and, you know. So I went up and I talked to my mom about it. And she said, Eric, scratch a goy and you'll find an anti-Semite. And what she meant by that was there were all anti-Semites. Right below the surface, a goy, meaning a non-Jew, in this case meaning a Christian, they all hate us. That's what you're going to find. Now, what I got out of that was also that she didn't mean it literally. She didn't really mean every Christian was an anti-Semite, but she meant it's enough true that it's worth the generalization. So it's like when I was in the 60s, and I'd work, I'd be very, very fortunate. I'd be one of the few white people in overwhelmingly black spaces. So I wasn't working in the so-called white civil rights movement. You know what I mean? I was working in the black civil rights movement. And I'd, you know, say, and the white man this, and the honky this, and that. That, you know, I'd like to kick a white man from what... I never thought they were talking about me. And they weren't talking about me.
Right.
They were talking about scratch a goy. You know, in general, the white folks are terrible. In general, white supremacy exists inside of white people. But they were right there, working with a white lawyer, working with a white fundraiser, working with a white civil rights worker. They didn't have to keep saying present company excluded.
Yeah.
They meant... Yeah, I mean, in general, these white folks are all messed up. And white society is the dominant culture. So I want to be clear, when my mom said, scratch a goy and you'll find an anti-Semite, she didn't really mean she hated all goyim, as it were.
Right.
But she was saying, you know what? When in doubt, assume they hate you. And I thought that was very helpful, actually, because unfortunately a lot of it has been true. And then you learn to make your friends based on what they really do. So to get to my last point, when I do something good, I don't say, aha, I'm upholding something good in the Jewish traditions. I more think I'm upholding something that my mom taught me, that Martin Luther King taught me, that Ho Chi Minh taught me, that Mao Zedong taught me, that all the people of ethics, like when Nelson Mandela in my book says, among the white people, the Jews have been unusually sympathetic to social justice, have been unusually sympathetic to the fight against apartheid because of the oppression that they have suffered. He didn't say because of their wonderful Jewish traditions, but rather, there's a whole story, I don't know if you know about Livonia, which my wife is, Leanne Hurst-Mann, has found a book. It's a wonderful book with Livonia in the title. And I think Livonia is a town in South Africa in which large numbers of Jews from, it turns out, Lithuania, which is both where Joe Slovo came from and Ruth First, his wife, came from. So a subculture of Jews in Lithuania ended up moving to South Africa. Guess what? They were overwhelmingly represented in the African National Congress and in the South African Communist Party. And many of them were secular Jews.
Sure.
So I guess what I'm saying, and thanks for letting me talk this long, is I do think there's a direct relationship between me and being a Jew and my politics. There's obviously a direct relationship between being a Jew and my personality. But I come out of the Jews who are internationalists by instinct, who are not trying to form, and I don't mean, well, let me say, Jews against the war or Jews for this and that. I don't wake up in the morning that way.
Right.
I wake up to say, people against the war, in which you're black, you're Latino, you're Asian, you're Native American, you're a Christian, I'm a Jew. We all come to it from somewhere. And I like where I came from, but I'm much more interested in where I'm going.
Interesting. Well, we are here now, and you know, as your mother said, we started this discussion on the Jews and Negroes, back then it was called, are in the same boat. And I got to tell you, you know, as friends of mine know, I figure, yeah, I look white, but I'm Jewish. You know, it's not quite the same thing. Yes, my skin is that tone, but they're, you know, Christians, Goys, they know the difference. And you certainly experienced real anti-Semitism. And, you know, in terms of this connecting with social justice movements, and as we mentioned back 50 years ago in the summer of, you know, Freedom Summer, there were a lot of Jews involved there because to a large extent, maybe the suffering and what you said that Nelson Mandela said about Jews getting it, somehow getting it. I mean, yes, there's a huge variation among Jews as there is among Christians. I mean, you got your wacky right wing, you know, hating Christians all the way to, you know, a lot of good liberal, progressive, social justice oriented Christians as well. And on an upcoming show, I'm going to be talking to an Episcopal bishop who spoke out against some of the Israeli actions. And he has paid the price for that, too. So, you know, it really being for social justice doesn't necessarily connect with your ethnic background. And I want to talk, Eric.
Is it okay, Bert? I thought you raised a very interesting point I wanted to take a minute on.
Go right ahead.
Which is this issue of, are we Jewish, are we white, are we both? I think that because white has become a political category in the United States, like I don't identify as white, but I have to understand the fact that I don't identify as white, and I don't, doesn't mean that I'm not politically white. Because I'm the director of a civil rights organization. And not just a civil rights organization, but an overwhelmingly black and Latino organization. Overwhelmingly. Very few whites. And I'm the director, partly because I founded the Labor Community Strategy Center, www.thestrategycenter.org, in 1989, when I'd already been in the movement for 25 years. And in my 25 years, I'd worked exclusively almost under black and Latino leaders and Asian Pacific Islander leaders. And I was asked to set up this strategy center, which has turned out to be very successful. Now, I've always understood that when they talk about white folks, they're also talking about me, you know, because in the cultural world, I have a certain amount of white privilege, which I'm, you know, I can just walk down the street and have an experience that I didn't say, hey, I'm white. But on the other hand, what the blacks understood in 1964 that a lot of young black people don't understand today is what I say is, yeah, but the whites put me in the concentration camps. They saw me. They didn't see me as white. They saw me as some
other,
subhuman other.
Right.
That I didn't say, hey, wait, Hitler. Hey, remember, I'm white. I'm Jeremy. He said, no, you're not. Don't you dare think you are. So it's a complicated reality because I sort of more accept others' perception of me and being white. But in this case, I don't identify as black, but I do identify in this case as being a Jew, which is interesting. Because, and I've been using it more because for the young kids, they don't come out of this tradition. They don't know, like, they haven't seen the 50% of the Jews who went down to Mississippi. They haven't seen the very close relationship with blacks and Jews. They have been in overwhelmingly in inner city high schools where there are no white people. The whites have fled.
Right.
So they don't even know what a white person is, let, you know, and among their teachers, yeah, there are probably a lot of Jews. So I thought I just wanted to come back to say the issue of whiteness and Jewishness. On one level, I have to take responsibility that in a social category that I did not create, I have to take responsibility for being perceived as white. But I just realized I will not accept being white. I didn't form it. I don't agree with it. I don't identify with it. And so this is interesting. I'm a Jew. That's who I am. You're black. I'm a Jew.
That's who we are. Yeah. And our identity is important. And you write that that Israel tries to make a complete identity of itself and worldwide Jewry, as they are one and the same. They've always tried to maintain that. And you also write that those Jews who are militant opponents of anti-Semitism and Israeli policy can help provide some leadership in fighting both fronts. What is the special role that, you know, Jews concerned with Israeli policy have to play now? Because, you know, Israel and AIPAC have tried to say, oh, there's no disagreement among Jews. They're all, you know, marching in lockstep with Israel. So what is the special role now that those Jews like you and me who care about, you know, ethics and civil rights and, you know, social justice, what is our special role in this? Or maybe you don't think we have one.
No, I definitely think we have it. And I think that's, again, I mean, I hate when people are interviewed and I say, that's a very good question. But it is a very good question. I mean, I think that one of the things that, and I think Bert, what you said is very good, is, see, the Israeli government first wants every Jew to support them, right, and claims they speak on their behalf, and then they go kill Palestinian children. They have the largest outside Alpanot air concentration camp in the world.
Yep.
They have just stolen 1,000 more acres of land from the West Bank.
Yes.
More settlements. I mean, this is one of the most brutal governments in the world right now.
Yes.
And then, as you said, if you attack them, then you're considered an anti-Semite. So then it makes you, in some ways, what they also want us to do is drive us, I just thought of this, which is what you're saying. So therefore, it drives us, theoretically, after the attack through a plan, out of the fight against anti-Semitism, because after all, how can we fight anti-Semitism if we are the anti-Semites? Right? Very smart.
Mm.
But unfortunately, the world is a lot more complicated than Israel's lying about it. So the irony is that when there's real anti-Semitism that's not tied to Israel, Israel's not great on that either. And so it's the secular Jews, along with everybody else, who have to stand up to very specific acts of anti-Semitism. And here's another thing I've been trying to think through, and it's another article I want to do some work on, because I haven't studied Hamas enough. But as an example, and I want to be careful, but if Hamas makes a very anti-Semitic statement, then they say, see, now what are you going to do? They just say that they want to destroy Israel. They've actually said some, not just that, but they said some specifically, if they have anti-Semitic remarks about the people, of the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my answer would be, and this is, again, different from Michael Lerner, who keeps saying, I condemn it. I get it, Michael, you condemn it. Obviously, I disagree with it. But you know what? These are your slaves. So if you're holding people under slavery, and they don't have self-determination, what they say about you is very low on my list compared to what you did to them. You know, if they see a group of Israeli soldiers who have Jewish stars on, now let's assume this theoretical other group is anti-Semitic, not just anti-Israel. Obviously, that contradiction is partly going to get resolved because, in fact, Hamas does want to negotiate with Israel, and so does the PLO and the Palestinian Authority. So what each side says about each other is understood to not be necessarily what the outcome is going to be. You know, if the United States says, I can never live with Vietnam, they're a bunch of godless, heathen, atheist, murderers, the United States is still negotiating with Vietnam behind the scenes during the whole war. There are people from both sides talking to each other. Now, obviously, at a certain point, if there's a settlement between Hamas, Palestinian Authority, and Israel, sure, one of the settlements will be, please stop saying those terrible things about us.
Mm-hmm.
And they will. Of course they will. But it's hard to tell somebody who you're bombing and killing, and this is also their ideology, and they're in total powerlessness. They have so-called, the warriors use rockets, not missiles. They have rockets. And Israel has a missile shield. Israel has nuclear weapons. So can you imagine, as you're bombing the people of Nagasaki, you say, hey, did you hear what they said, those anti-American remarks they made? What the hell does one thing have to do with the other, dude? You have a nuclear war, and they have a mouth. And I'm sorry, I'm not that upset at what they say, because I know enough about politics that you don't want Hamas to get together with the Palestinian Authority. That's why you're attacking them. You're not worried about what they say about you. That's your excuse to kill them. And then you have other people. I'm sorry to be on my Michael Lerner jag, but he keeps saying Hamas should do this. If I was Hamas, I wouldn't do... Hey, you know what, Michael? It's none of your business. It's none of our business. We're not telling the people of Hamas how to wage the liberation struggle. Our job is to stop the occupation. Our job is to end U.S. aid to Israel. Our job is to condemn Israeli murdering of Palestinian civilians. Our job is to allow free motion between all the Palestinian states. Your listeners know that right now, people in Gaza who have disagreements with people in the West Bank, they're almost trying to make them into two separate countries that are going to not get to know each other. Because there's not even free passage between the West Bank and Gaza. Did people know that? So when they say the Palestinians, Israel doesn't even want Palestine to exist, doesn't want a two-state solution. So no, when you say, did you hear that Hamas said this and that and this and that, aren't you upset? I said, I don't agree with it. I think it's anti-Semitic. I wouldn't kill their kids over it. I think it's another example. And they'll say, see, that's because you're an anti-Semite. I'll say, no, that's because I'm against mass murder, my friend. Don't support genocide.
Yeah.
And what the hell the people say who you have in a concentration camp is very low on my list of outrages.
Good point. If you just tuned into the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Eric Mann. We're talking about charges of anti-Semitism, self-hating Jews. He's talking about self-respecting Jews and how going on the offensive about that. Now, Eric, I got to ask, might there be some people who say you and I are being myopic, that the Palestinians are really outside the standards of worldwide social justice movement, and that they really are bad guys, and that perhaps we who criticize Israeli policies are taken in as naively romanticizing the underdog, which is kind of traditional to romanticize the underdog. What's your response to that?
Well, what I would say is I always romanticize the underdog because that means that I hate the top dog. And I don't, you know, Marx did a very good thing and Lenin did a very good thing. When they talked about it as a strategy, they said, look, if you're trying to take on the United States government, and the United States government is the main danger in the world, as my friend Martin Luther King said when he was asked to condemn the urban rebellions, he said, how can I condemn poor people trying to rise up against oppression when my own government is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world? Now, if you think your government is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, then the strategy is to weaken your own government. The strategy is to stop the United States from interfering in the internal affairs now of Syria, of Libya, of Iraq, of Iran, of Yemen, of England, of taping the Angela Merkel. I mean, this is a government that is spying on the whole world, our government. So living inside the United States, my strategy is to weaken and eventually eliminate the structure of U.S. imperialism. And therefore, I do unite with the underdogs, not just on a moral level, but on a strategic level. Because I think, for instance, whether I agree, so that's the first thing. The second thing is what's called self-determination. I'm not in Palestine. I'm not in South Africa. I'm not in the countries that my country is oppressing. I have enough problem with the government in my country. I am not here to make judgments on what are the politics of the underdog. If Palestine wants self-determination and their own nation, they have that right. They can elect fascists to it. I may not like that. They could elect communists. And you know what? The United States would be much happier, by the way, if they elected fascists. If they elected communists, then they'd really be in trouble. So, you know, the United States doesn't believe in self-determination, right? I mean, it's now we're against ISIS. I barely know what ISIS is. I thought we were against Al-Qaeda. Now we're against, you know, they just make it up. It's like wag the dog, you know? So my point is, let me stay on the point. You said, in your support for the underdog, are you not aware that some of these underdogs may have very bad politics? And my answer is that the United States has no ethical principles around which it makes any judgments in the world. It has supported the Guatemalan genocide.
Mm.
It has carried out 4 million murders against the people of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It has supported the Shah of Iran. It supported every dictator in the world. So please don't tell me if it's supporting every dictator in the world, then my job is to support those people who are underdogs, rising up not just against those dictators, but those U.S.-sponsored and supported dictators like the government of Israel. That's a strategic point. Now, once those people reach self-determination and have the chance for sovereignty, what they do with their sovereignty is not my business.
Right.
It's not. I'm not sitting here waiting to see if I like every government that comes to power. What I'm looking for, at least, is a world of sovereign states and nations that, through the United Nations and other bodies, can try to get along without the utilization of war as a mechanism of resolving disputes. When I keep saying, why do I keep saying in my article, the Palestinian people? Why do I say in my article, their right to self-determination? Why do I not say in my article, support for Hamas, support for the Palestine Authority? Not because I don't, but what I say in my article is, give them the right to meet with each other. That's what I'm saying. Give the forces in Palestine, they're not even allowed to get on a bus and talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to support them to know that it's better if they get along. And I know that Israel is doing everything it can to prevent a unified Palestinian conversation, let alone movement.
Well, I think I'm getting the sense that history, we are at some sort of a tipping point, and there's a long way to go, as you write in the article. We don't always see it at the time, but in retrospect, when the tide turns and seemingly impossible revolutionary objectives become shockingly possible, we're starting to see a turn, I think. Now, in Washington, under the Capitol Dome, AIPAC basically owns the place. Doesn't matter if you're right-wing, conservative, moderate, liberal, they have tremendous, absolute, total power over every single member of Congress. Not one dares to criticize Israel at all for being called anti-Semitic. You, Eric Mann, you had a column in the Boston Globe, as you were telling me, when you expressed criticism of Israeli policy. That ended that. The fear of being called anti-Semitic if you criticize Israel is clearly intense and powerful. And there is real personal risk if you just criticize Israel. How frightening might it be to speak out as just a citizen? And you have some strategies and some historic knowledge of how we can deal with that.
Well, I think the first thing that's very important is before we leave the show, I want to honestly say to people that one of the things that I think is very important for those listening to the show is, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
You know, like me and Bert are having a great conversation. We think it's a brilliant conversation, but of course that's us. But you're out there. We don't know how many of you are out there. But radio and television is not supposed to be a spectator sport. It's not supposed to be, oh, that was a really interesting conversation. Eric said this and Bert said this. Well, what do you plan to do about it? Do? Oh, nothing. I just, now this is happening. No, no, no. We're not here to entertain you, folks. There's other shows on to entertain you. So I'll see what I want from you, which is very little. The first is I'd like you to go up on my website, which is from a radio show called Voices from the Frontlines, www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. You're going to see a very beautiful website there. On that website, you're going to hear this interview in about 2 or 3 days, because even though it's not coming from Voices, when I do other interviews,
sure,
we download those interviews onto the site. So you'll be able to hear Bert, and Bert will tell you how to hear us directly. But you'll also hear the Bert Cohen Show, not every week, but you'll hear this interview, just like I did one on Middle Eastern Focus in Los Angeles, downloaded onto our site. And look for the picture of Bert, who's going to send me a really nice picture, but it has to be within 5 years of your present age. It can't be adopted. Photoshop from your 40s. But so that's one thing you can do. The second thing is really important to me is to send me an email at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. I've been getting like up to about 75 amazing emails, not just emails, but people doing real things. I'm a public school teacher and would like to use your speech, you know, I'd like to use your article. Could we translate into Spanish? I'm in Germany, and I want to use it, you know, because there's a conversation going on in anti-Semitism.
Oh,
so I need to know who's out there. So if I get an email that says, eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com, I heard you on the Bert Cohen Show, that means a lot. Now, before we end up, Bert, what do you want them to do?
Well, thank you for asking that. I think it's important. I've said before, protest and politics, both are necessary. Neither is sufficient. You and I may disagree with that, but I think you have to have protest as well as be involved politically. And I've been elected myself, and it's important to put pressure on our elected officials, I think, to let members of Congress, your member of Congress, your U.S. senator, to know that, hey, you know what? You don't agree with what the state of Israel is doing now, and if you're Jewish, say you're a self-respecting Jew. That's important to say. I think it's important to try to change Congress, to put pressure on them, to let them know, yeah, the public is changing its opinion. It's important. Get out on the streets. Make that noise. Let our politicians see that the public opinion really is changing. And that you see it, and, you know, again, protest and politics, they're both necessary, in my opinion, to make real change. We have to speak up. We cannot be intimidated. AIPAC, I believe, is in the business of intimidating. And one thing I'm going to diverge a little bit here, but talk about AIPAC's power. In universities in America, in the wake of the Gaza massacres, the civility police are cracking down hard. Administrators and trustees at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign used the excuse of civility to fire a professor, Stephen Saleta, for his criticism of Israel's slaughter of hundreds of children in Gaza. He been under attack there as being anti-Semitic, and they're saying it's uncivil if you criticize Israel. We got to stand up to that, and that is starting to happen. You know, criticism of Israeli policies is being defined as uncivil, and such speech is declared to be outside of civil bounds. We need to address that. It is absolutely, I mean. Does AIPAC own civility? I don't think so. Back to you, Eric.
Well, I think to stay on that, I think what you're right about is that, see, I because I believe in guerrilla warfare, I think you never attack the enemy at their strongest point. Like, you'd have to pay me to go to D.C. It's a cesspool. There's no chance of changing D.C. But like in guerrilla war, the enemy controls the cities, the enemy controls the universities, you know, they control all the areas where they think power is, and then they leave the rest of the people to rot, you know, like in Black and Latino communities, they beat them up, they imprison 2.5 million people, they deport 11 million people, 400,000 at a time. They're leaving people with complete poverty right now, no jobs. Some people working 2-3 jobs. They've moved to a low-wage, conditional workforce. They've cut every social service. So that's not their strong suit. That's not where AIPAC is powerful. If you go into the black community and say, hey, guess what, don't say this because AIPAC's going to get you, they'll go, what the hell is AIPAC? Is that like a six-pack? Or what the hell is an AIPAC? You know, and AIPAC has no more authority. AIPAC has no more authority in most working-class communities because of all races, because that's not what they're trying to do. They just figure, well, what the hell? You guys can rot in hell. I'm going to take over Congress. So one of the ways it can work is, you know, a congressman's going and he's having his happy little kiss-ass handshaking day, and he shows up at some church, and they say, hey, what are you going to do about cutting off aid to Israel? What? No, I'm here to kiss a baby. No. What about Israel? Wait a minute. This isn't a synagogue. Why are you talking about this? Oh, because I'm a part of the L.A. Human Rights Coalition, and we're asking you to cut off all aid to Israel and actually to get out of the Middle East altogether. And he goes, well, yeah, thank you very much. I don't agree with you, but, you know, that's what makes America great. And he goes back to what he thinks, that's no big thing, you know, stupid church, what the hell do I care? And then he just, you know, smokes drugs with all the lobbyists and has a good time. And then he goes back to his district again. He goes to a Catholic church and kisses babies. And they say, excuse me, are you going to cut off aid to Israel? And he says, what the hell are you talking about? Wait a minute, what's going on here?
Right, exactly.
The aide says, you know, something's going on in your district, bro. I don't know how they've done it, but they are starting to reach people on this. You go into high schools, you go into churches, you go, you know, you won't go to synagogues, I'm sorry, not for a long, long time, but you go to secular groups, and all of a sudden, and then somebody's going to run against them. And somebody's going to run, which is what we did during the 60s. And somebody really prominent, a professor, a minister, saying, you know what, I'm running on a human rights campaign. And when they first start to run, they don't have very much money, but some of them get very smart and good, and they know how to run a good campaign. And they go into this person's district, and these congressional districts are not that big, and the person's going to win. That's not what the question is. But somebody gets enough votes that they get on the debates so that every place the congressman goes, there's this other congressional candidate. And every place the congressman goes, they say, are you going to stop the murder of Palestinian children? Are you going to free 2.5 million prisoners? Are you going to stop the drone attacks? Are you going to stop mass deportations? Are you going to have no cars in L.A.? And even though he's going to win, he's saying, I'm not enjoying these debates anymore. You know, these debates are not fun. I'm ducking every one of these questions. They are now organizing people who have an alternate plan. And my strategy part is the first thing that the movement has not done, which we did in the 60s, is we have not set ourselves up as an effective, organized counterpole in U.S. life. Because it takes 5%, I always tell the organizers, Felipe Villarreal, I said, when we are up against Mayor Garcetti and there's 100 people in the room, and you stand up and say you want to cut the police budget by 50%, and then you stand up and say, who wants to cut the police budget by 50%, and three people raise their hand, what do you think Garcetti is thinking?
It's starting to happen.
That's right. That Felipe is saying to me, he now knows they got 3 out of 100 already. And he's seeing other people coming up to me afterwards and saying, well, tell me more about cutting. I agree, but why'd you say that? He sees 15 people surrounding me, some yelling at me, some agreeing with me, and he's watching and saying, like Satchel Paige said, don't look back if somebody's gaining on you. He sees the organized.
Absolutely.
He sees you building a base. And damn it, the left is not doing that right now. So I don't blame AIPAC. I blame us. We're not doing the job. So that's why you've got to send me an email at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Because if you don't send me that email, then you're not really doing anything.
Well, we have to let it go with that. We could talk another couple of hours on this fascinating stuff. I'm so glad you came on the show, Eric Mann. Again, the website is voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Thank you so much, and it's up to you and me and everybody listening to take action ourselves, to do something. Citizenship is not a spectator sport. Thank you, Eric Mann, for being with us.
Take good care, Bert.
You too. Well, don't you let nobody turn you around, turn you around, turn you around. Well, don't you let nobody turn you around. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land.
You let nobody turn you round. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land. Well, don't you let the policeman turn you round, turn you round, turn you round. Well, don't let the policeman turn you round. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land. Well, don't let the politician turn you round. Slow you down, don't let the politician slow you down. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land.